Thanks for listening to Up First. We want to know who's listening and how you're using podcasts.
Please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey, all one word. It takes less than 10 minutes, and it really helps us.
That's npr.org/podcastsurvey.
We begin this weekend with more than 1.1 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus in the U.S., and more than 65,000 Americans have died.
The president says weekending at Camp David sends a good signal.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, and this is Up First from NPR News.
At the White House, a new media strategy.
Will you pledge never to lie to us from that podium?
I will never lie to you. You have my word on that.
The Brazilian president mocked governor's stay-at-home orders, but the death toll there is rising.
And in New York City, EMTs are canvassing for coronavirus patients who should be in the hospital.
They're not sure. It's like, oh, should I go? Should I not? People are afraid, like, oh, it has to be severe. But a day could be life or death.
So stay with us. We'll give you the news you need to start your weekend.
Support for NPR comes from Trello, part of the Atlassian Collaboration Suite. During these uncertain times, Trello is here to help teams work together to solve big challenges. Trello helps teams communicate, focus, and connect. Try Trello for free and learn more at Trello.com.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp. Online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in isolation, depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit BetterHelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Brazil is rapidly becoming a new front line in the war against the coronavirus. Officially, more than 6,000 Brazilians have so far died due to COVID-19. The true death toll is likely to be much higher.
Officials are preparing for numbers to rise sharply in the coming weeks. And as governors and mayors desperately scramble for resources, Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, is trying to deflect blame. NPR's Philip Reeves joins us from Rio de Janeiro. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
So what is the situation?
It's bad and it's getting worse. Brazil now has more deaths than China. It's become a global hotspot. The health minister here is warning that we could soon have 1,000 deaths a day, meaning a 24-hour period. The governor of Sao Paulo, where the country's biggest city is located, is saying that 90% of intensive care beds are already occupied. They may have this weekend to send serious cases out into the countryside to get treatment. People are building field hospitals as fast as they can. There are problems with staff getting sick, problems getting equipment. And here in Rio, there's a major shortage of intensive care beds. And in parts of the north and northeast of Brazil, they're already out of beds and the public health system's overwhelmed.
And this is a country, of course, with a great deal of inequality. Is Jair Bolsonaro still in denial? When the virus first struck, we heard him play down the threat. I believe he called COVID-19 a little flu. Has he changed his tune?
Not really. A lot of governors and mayors here are begging people to stay home, but Bolsonaro is going around making it clear that he's against broad social isolation because of the massive economic and social damage that causes, and he thinks these measures don't work. Now, you know, that's a view some people take. Most doctors wouldn't agree with it, but some people see it that way. But Bolsonaro goes a step further. He very flamboyantly subverts social distancing rules in his personal behavior. He shakes hands with people. He goes out and meets supporters, usually doesn't wear a mask. He seems to believe that deaths caused by COVID-19 are unavoidable. You know, he was asked the other day about the rising numbers, and he replied, "So what? Sorry, what do you want me to do? I can't work miracles." And that really upsets people, especially people in the front line. One of the worst hit cities here is Manaus in the north. The health system there has completely collapsed. They're using mass graves because of the number of people dying. The mayor of Manaus, Artur Virgilio, went on CNN Brazil yesterday, and he made this appeal to Bolsonaro.
Eu diria, Presidente Bolsonaro, fique em casa. Fique em casa.
Stay at home, President Bolsonaro, he says. And the mayor went on to urge Bolsonaro to remember, look, Brazilians voted for you to be a leader, to keep them safe, not to lead them to anguish and exhaustion.
Precisa você ser uma pessoa muito cínica, uma pessoa muito insensata para não sentir isso profundamente no fundo do seu coração.
You have to be very cynical, very unreasonable, not to feel that deep in your heart, the mayor tells Bolsonaro. And as you can hear from his voice, he feels very strongly about this.
Bolsonaro is a populist leader from the far right. And I have to say, this sounds quite familiar. Mixed signals coming from a president and governors. There has been political turmoil in Jair Bolsonaro's government. How firm is his grip on power now?
He is in some trouble. In the middle of a pandemic, with Brazil's economy nosediving, by accident or design, Bolsonaro's triggered a political crisis. He sacked the federal police chief. His highly popular justice minister quit, saying that that is political interference in law enforcement. The Supreme Court has now given the go-ahead to a criminal investigation into Bolsonaro's conduct, and there are growing calls for Bolsonaro's impeachment. And this isn't the first political upheaval we've had here recently, mid-pandemic. Remember, last month, Bolsonaro upset a lot of people by firing his health minister. Yet polls show that his support still comes in at around 33%, so his core support's still there, and his opponents are divided. And some of them think this just isn't the right time to move against him.
That is NPR's Philip Reeves in Brazil. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
President Trump took off for Camp David last night. He's spending what the White House calls a working weekend there.
It's part of a shift in how the administration is showing that it's working to get things back to some kind of normal. And it's a change of scene.
I've been at the White House now for many months, and I'd like to get out. As much as I love this, this is the most beautiful house in the world, in my opinion. But I think there's just a great demand to get out and, you know, get our country going again. And that includes going to restaurants and hotels.
To be clear, it's only been a little more than a month since President Trump last left the White House.
White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now to talk about how things are shifting. Good morning.
Good morning.
So for weeks, we've all been watching the president at the White House briefings. But last week, he said he wanted to step back. So what's happening?
President Trump spent a total of more than 30 hours speaking at those coronavirus task force briefings over about a month and a half.
30
hours. And that's according to an analysis from the website Factbase that they ran for NPR. You know, he really seemed to relish those briefings, but his poll numbers had taken a hit. And there was, of course, the disinfectants briefing that pretty much killed his briefings. So instead, this week, we've been seeing the president hold more events where there's no expectation that you'll even hear from the public health experts. The point of these events are so that the president and the White House can push out good news stories and focus on the next steps, you know, reopening businesses instead of focusing on the public health crisis. In fact, the president has even started talking about it in the past tense.
It's a war against the invisible enemy, and we're now on the other side, and what I want to see is I want to see where it was. And I think we have a chance to have an incredible year next year.
This is all part of an administration trying to signal that it's time to move on.
And we should be clear, of course, that there's no evidence that we're on the other side of this crisis yet.
Very important point. Yeah.
To that point, actually, a House committee wanted to hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci this week. But the White House is declining to make him available. What is the reason?
Yeah, so it was a subcommittee in the Appropriations Committee. They wanted Fauci to testify Wednesday. A White House spokesman says that Fauci was basically too busy. They put out a statement saying it would be counterproductive to have people like Fauci involved in the response and trying to develop vaccines tied up with a hearing. And the statement goes on to say that the White House does intend to work with Congress to offer testimony at the appropriate time.
All right. And yesterday we had the new press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, do her first briefing. Do you think we'll see a return to sort of more traditional kind of daily press briefing that has been absent? And what's the strategy?
You know, it's been a long time. There had been 417 days without a daily press briefing before McEnany held hers.
That's over a year.
That is over a year. There was an entire press secretary's tenure that involved no briefings. But McEnany says that there are times like now when it will work for her to take questions. And that this is especially as the White House is trying to shift that focus away from the health crisis.
Americans are looking to reopening the country. We've had Dr. Birx in several events this week. They've been Dr. Birx and Fauci out on the airwaves. They're really incredible people and have done a great service for this country. But we allow the news of the day to guide us, what the American people need to hear. And right now we're in a reopening phase, which is why you've seen the president this week with CEOs. You've seen him with small business owners.
You know, she also used the briefing to bring up things completely unrelated to the coronavirus, including Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor who's trying to appeal his guilty plea. You know, this doesn't mean that we aren't going to hear from the president. In fact, we're hearing from him lots. On Sunday night, he will choose another setting. He's doing a Fox News town hall at the Lincoln Memorial. And on Tuesday, he is traveling to Arizona to a mask-making facility, once again trying to show that he can get out, that things are getting back to some sort of normal. And of course, Arizona is also a state critical for his reelection plans.
That's NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And you can get the latest from the White House or this weekend Camp David and the campaign trail by subscribing to the NPR Politics Podcast.
Some cities are taking a new approach to testing people for the coronavirus. EMTs are going door to door explaining the symptoms of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, and offering the test to people in their homes.
The goal is try to find and test people who don't know how to get tested or don't know that they should be tested. And NPR's Rebecca Hersher has been talking to some of the EMTs who've been doing this work in New York City public housing and joins us now. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks so much.
The idea sounds promising. Does it seem to work?
Well, it's still early. These programs are still ramping up now in just about half a dozen cities. And New York City is one of them. One of the issues there is that people have been dying in their homes, which suggests that they are not being tested and they're not being treated. And so the city is having EMTs go door to door, focused on public housing complexes where there are a lot of people. And I talked to one of the EMTs, 24-year-old May Lynn Rojas, while she was working this week in the Bronx.
It's been pretty hectic, pretty busy, doing a lot of COVID calls. Yeah.
Here's how she says her days go. She has personal protective equipment and a bunch of flyers with the symptoms of COVID-19. She knocks on a door, hands over a flyer, and then asks, does anyone here have these symptoms?
Yesterday, I was actually handing out flyers for a good portion of the day, going door to door, and it's about over 100 apartments, and the amount of people is like unknown in every building.
Because some apartments have one person, some have large families, and then if someone does have symptoms, she can set up a call right there with a doctor, a telemedicine appointment with a doctor or nurse practitioner who can decide whether to order a COVID-19 test. And if they do, she can do it right there. And at the end of the day, she drops off all the samples she's collected at UPS and they get shipped off to a commercial lab, which sends back results in a couple days.
Becky, you mentioned that New York City has a high number, shockingly high number of people dying at home. This is how they're trying to deal with that?
Yeah. And, you know, the ultimate goal here is to find people who are not seeking out medical treatment or testing on their own, maybe because they don't know how to do that, maybe because they're afraid to leave the house. And another EMT I talked to, her name's Judy Vidal, she said even when it's clear that a person is quite ill, and she's seen this, sometimes they feel scared about the idea of even going to a hospital.
They're not sure. It's like, oh, should I go? Should I not? People are afraid, like, oh, it has to be severe. But a day could be life or death.
And she sees part of her job as talking family members into having this person go to the hospital. And she explains that people with COVID-19 can get critically ill without much warning.
We just have to persuade these patients to take that step. And their family, too, especially if we're talking about grandma and grandpa. We know that your parents are going to be at the hospital by themselves. It's going to feel lonely. It's going to feel strange. But, you know, the silver lining is that they'll come back. And we know we can't promise. That's the hard thing. We can't promise that their relative is going to come back because, you know, we don't know.
Rebecca, how does this program, this effort, fit into the larger push in New York to try to test more people?
You know, it's a relatively small piece, but it's important. It's hard to scale because it takes a long time to do each of these tests. Often they take an hour or more. But it's really important because it's allowing cities to more proactively test people who wouldn't do it on their own.
Rebecca Hirscher of NPR Science Desk, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And that's Up First for Saturday, May 2nd, 2020. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon. Up First is back Monday with the news you need to start your week. And follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And of course, you know the news doesn't stop when this podcast ends. We have a solution for that.
Weekend edition, Saturday and Sunday. You can find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
Hey, it's Guy Raz from NPR's How I Built This, and each week on the show during this unprecedented crisis, I'll be asking some of the top founders and builders how they're dealing with the economic impact of the coronavirus and hear about some of the ways they're pivoting to fight it. Subscribe or listen now to How I Built This.